Good morning. My name is Moses Titus Nhlanga, permanent delegate from Mpumalanga, a member of this committee. Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Kelwa mutlatsilo ke khale re go masema no bona go tswa go kapa botlo le go la committee.
Thank you, Chair. My name is James Ntetra, a member of this committee.
Bagetso dumelang. Lena la ka ke Tebogo Mokwele. Ke moleloko wa komiti. Ke tswa ke le ko Bokone Bophirima. Ke a leboga.
Good morning. My name is Jihad Mohapi, a member of the committee from Free State.
Good morning. I'm George Michalakis from the Free State.
Good morning, Morgan Chetty, permanent delegate, KZN.
Morning, Chair, ladies and gentlemen. Bronwyn Engelbrecht, permanent delegate from Gauteng.
Thank you very much, honourable member. Honourable Ziad Mohapi is the chairperson of Cocktails, and Honourable Mtetwa is the whip of this committee. Thank you very much. Over to Department of Justice, and also our guests will introduce themselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Lawrence Bassett from Department of Justice.
Morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Henk Tepleer, also from the Department of Justice.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Inga Antong. I'm new to the Department of Justice, Western Cape Office. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Alison Tilley, and I'm from the Open Democracy Advice Center.
Good morning. I'm Lorraine Martin from the Open Democracy Advice Center.
Good morning, I'm Shamlam Velasa from Corruption Watch.
Good morning, Chair. Honourable members, Leanne Govinswamy from Corruption Watch.
Good morning, Leona Mkandawea from PMG. I'm a monitor there.
Around me, my support officers, secretary and content advisor. Thank you very much. Honourable members, let me welcome you to this committee. Feel free, do your work as you are coming to do, present to the honourable members. They are listening to you, waiting for you. They are aware that you are coming. Please take your chance. But the only thing that I would like to, when you present, I think you're going to present your presentation. You know it. There's no need of word to word. Thank you very much. Honourable members, something that I would like to appeal to you. For instance, our first item, we're expecting a presentation by the Open Democracy Advice Center on the Protected Disclosures Amendment B. And also, another presenter for us today is an Corruption Watch. I was thinking that if we can see the program, say that we'll get briefing, and after that, Department of Justice, and then the committee, and then again, Corruption Watch and briefing Department of Justice. I was advising that what we can take the Democracy Center, Advisory Center, after that we get the oral presentation by the Corruption Watch. Then the Department of Justice just summarize all these things after that. Then the committee then interrupted for both presentations. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I don't know, maybe it will be my lack of understanding of the processes, internal processes of Parliament. But I think I just need to be clear, dear Chair. I can see here in front of us in our agenda, as you're saying, we're having the presentation by the Democratic Advisory Center on the bill itself. My question perhaps will be a clarity-seeking, Chair. Is it not advisable for us as a committee to first have internal briefings with the department on the bill itself, then it followed the advisory committee, the democratic Democratic Advisory Center because I believe it's a section, it's a Section 21 institution or what. And then it can then follow to the previous, because I think in my understanding is that the department must give us its internal take on the bill. Then from there we can then get the advice from whoever that is interested or is affected by the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think we once had the presentation by the department. Let's allow my submission to you, Chair, will be, I know we have adopted the program, but my submission will be let's allow stakeholders to present to us, because we once had the presentation by the department. Perhaps if there are some submissions that they need us to recognize and know, so be it. What I would suggest should happen is that after the presentation of both stakeholders, and then we engage before we give the department, we engage with the presentation by both stakeholders, and then we allow the department maybe to come up with some clarity-seeking questions or submissions that they will need to do, and then we move forward. I think by doing that, I don't know. I was thinking that.
Yes, thing. Honorable.
No, thank you, Chair. My name is led to your proposal and the way forward of how to proceed in this proceeding of today. I think I would like to formally move forward for the proposal that you've made with regards to taking two presentations, and then from there, and then the department, and also breakfast, because of to us, you will be interacting with the two presenters, only to find out the department, I will be able to clarify certain things. So we'll be doing this thing in the orderly manner. Instead of saying that, give them the chance and then the response, and the time that we still think that there are some matters that the department has not addressed, then we also need some better clarity from the two presenters, the two organizations here, to be able to respond. That is my take. Formally move the for the proposal that we've made, Chair, that we proceed in this matter.
Thank you very much. I think it's just you and Honorable a little bit supporting each other, but it's just the way of putting things. Really, the department had a presentation to us to this matter. So I think we'll hand over to the presenters. First, it'll be Democracy Advice Center on the Protection Disclosures Amendment Bill to present to us. Then we'll be followed by the Corruption Watch. Thank you very much. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Chair, Honourable Mr. Klimbi, and thank you very much to the members of the committee. In the Portfolio Committee, we were able to make submissions around this legislation, and we had an engagement with the Department of Justice subsequent to that, and a number of amendments have been made. When I first started talking about this legislation, I said if this legislation was a person, they would be tall, handsome, and have a nice singing voice, because we're very happy overall with the legislation. So there's a lot of the legislation that meets the concerns that we've had, and we'd like to acknowledge the engagement with the Department of Justice, which has allowed us to reach consensus on a number of sections. The one section that we're really concerned about, and it really is the only one section for us, although we do agree with the submissions of our colleagues from Corruption Watch, there is one section that is the problem. And what that section does is creates a criminal offence if you intentionally disclose false information. And I think one of the issues in the Portfolio Committee was essentially that the members of the committee felt that they charges that were being made, and that under the circumstances they felt that this bill was the appropriate point to deal with that, and the way to deal with that was to create a criminal offence. Now, this legislation has come a long way. It started in the South African Law Reform Commission, so there was a Law Reform Commission process. There have been submissions along the way. I think when the draft was published in the Gazette, there were submissions at that stage. And we, at that point, this section was not in the bill. So this section was introduced just before it came into Parliament. And we were immediately very concerned about it. It was not something the Law Reform Commission recommended. And from our point of view, there is a good reason for that. And in order to explain that, allow me to sketch the sort of framework of the bill or the act. The idea with the act, when it was originally introduced in the Justice Committee, which was in, as I recall, 2001, was to create a framework which would assist whistleblowers. And I think there's sometimes a concern about whistleblowers and what they do and what their intentions are. But what the legislation does is really create a framework for raising concerns. And the way the legislation sets up that protection for that person is to say you must raise your concern internally in your organization. And if that is ignored, and if that issue is not being resolved, at that point, if you go outside of your organization, and it's to different agencies, it could be the public protector or the auditor general or some other institutions, that you will attract the protection of the act. And Johnny DeLange talked about it as a shield, not a sword. And that is very much the sort of framework of the thing. So what it's intended to do is members of Parliament fall sort of outside this category because they're not considered employees. But if one of the employees of Parliament sees something that concerns them, you know, that they suspect, and it's often we talk about fraud in this circumstance, but the act is actually much wider. It talks about racism, it talks about environmental damage. Parliament's kitchen is dumping the cooking oil into the drains and not sending it away for cleaning properly. It could be any one of those issues. Those employees, if they first, their duty must be to raise the concern internally to their supervisor, to their line manager. And often, that's actually where it gets resolved. You know, there are so many cases that we never hear about because, you know, people say, oh, well, let's go and investigate it, and it gets sorted out. But there are those situations where people then realize that the problem is not going to be fixed within their organization. Let's say it was a small business where the cooking oil is being dumped. You've raised it with the boss of the business. There's nobody else to talk to. What are you going to do? The idea with the act is that it allows you to then go outside of your organization and speak about the problem and yet still be protected as an employee. So your employer is not allowed to then say, well, you know, I'm going to dismiss you because you've brought the organization into disrepute. Why do we do that? We do that because it is in the public interest that we learn about what is going on. It's definitely not in our interest that our drinking water will become our drinking water is polluted by oil. It's just, you know, we don't want that. So the theory is that it's in the public interest to do this. What we find, and my colleague Lorraine is the person who runs the helpline at ODAC. We've been running a helpline for whistleblowers to try and explain the law to them for many years, and I think the helpline was launched in 2002. And over that period of time, we've been explaining what the issues are, and there have been a number of gaps in the law that have come to our attention, and we've raised those gaps, and this law goes a long way to fix those gaps. So one of the issues was independent contractors were not protected. So you can be a consultant, you come into a business, you see that there's racism, you are like, well, this is not in terms of policies of this company, it breaches PAPUDA or the Equality Act. I raise the concern and I'm ignored. And in this instance, this act changes that to protect that that contractor. So we're very happy about that kind of change. What we found on the helpline is that it's not a question of having to hold people back from raising concerns. There's not a lot of what we would find as sort of reckless whistleblowing. What we tend to find is exactly the opposite, is people really considering very carefully whether they should raise these concerns, because often it's not in your interest as an employee to rock the boat, right? You're going to get into trouble, and often very serious trouble. I mean, if there's a serious issue going on in the company or you know, wherever you are, we've seen, unfortunately, the trend is that the threats against whistleblowers have escalated. So when we first started on the helpline, we were concerned about, you know, suspensions, dismissals, being moved to a branch that you know, don't want to work at because it's far away from your home, that sort of level of threat. We've now got to the point where we are seeing whistleblowers that are being assassinated. So people have to take raising concerns very seriously. And in this situation, on the helpline, I have to say we never say to people, you should blow the whistle, because we are aware of what the consequences can be. So what we'll say to people is, look, this is the best advice we can give you, but at the end of the day, it's got to be your decision, because only you can judge the risk where you are. You know, we can't judge that for you, and we can't tell you that you must, because we are not in your shoes. If the information is false, and we're not denying that that ever happens, certainly it does happen. It's one of the reasons we recommend companies and government don't set up anonymous hotlines, because the anonymity of it allows people to say all sorts of things and it doesn't attract to them as a person. But when a person raises false concerns, you must remember that this is in the workplace now. This is not just sort of generally in the world. This is when you are employed by somebody and you go to somebody in your office and you say, that person is throwing the used oil in the drains. And they're not actually doing that. But you want to get that person in trouble. And the next thing, there's an investigation and there are question marks over that person's head. Now, in the workplace, what is the remedy for your employer? Well, it's to sanction you and to dismiss you, right? There's also remedies to you in defamation. And we've been told that, well, you know, that's not a great remedy because you've got to go and pay lawyers and that's expensive. And that is true. But on the other hand, if you are making a misrepresentation and that misrepresentation results in your gain, we would then argue that there is actually a criminal sanction that attaches to that anyway. So what does 9B do in addition to all of this? What it does is it creates a new self-standing submission crime. And what it says is that you disclose false information and you know that the information is false, or you ought reasonably to have known that the information is false. And you have the intention to cause harm to the affected party, and the affected party has suffered harm, you are then guilty of an offence. Now, I know that in the portfolio committee, the members looked at that and said, well, that seems like you've done a bad thing. You should be punished. And our answer to that is, indeed, you have done a bad thing. And you should be punished. And you should be punished by the various sanctions that are already available. What we don't want to be is in the situation where we are then advising whistleblowers on our helpline and saying, look, you have to do this properly or you're not going to attract the attention of the law. You're not going to get that shield that's going to protect you. Yes, we know that, and previous to now, you know, that then you're not going to get significant damages, that the law changes that. And yes, it is a very serious thing to do, and you may well find that, you know, you are out of a job, because that is what we know employers do. So they will suspend you, they will, and then if you win on the suspension, they'll find another way to get rid of you. I mean, employers will find a way. We've had the most bizarre things where people start monitoring the mileage on the company car and then saying, oh, look, you've too much. Another one, which sort of take note, is where you hand in your sick note, your medical certificate from your doctor, you don't keep a copy, and then they say, oh, no, sorry, we can't find any sick notes from you. You were absent without leave. Okay, so make copies of your sick notes. We've been in this position, and we really feel that an additional threat to whistleblowers, who remember are not acting in their own interests, they're not involved in a grievance procedure, they're not saying, I didn't get promoted, or I didn't get whatever, they're saying, I see a concern in this organization, and I want to raise this in the public interest. And we are threatening this person. And they may say, well, you know, I'm telling the truth. Will they know I'm telling the truth? Must I investigate it, that it's the truth? And we say to people, no, don't investigate. It's not in your job description to become a private detective in your organization. Don't start snooping through files to try and prove whether you're right or not, because that in and of itself is an offense in the workplace. So that's our experience in South Africa. We then had a look at the opinion which was provided by the Department of Justice, and we happened to be a member of the Whistleblowing International Networks. And these are organizations from around the world, and you'll see some in Europe, one in Japan, some in South America, the UK, and the US. And we put it to them. We said, look, you guys, what do you think? Are we overreacting? And what they did was come back with what I think is a comprehensive assessment of both the Department of Justice memo and their experience of the international best practice. And as the chair has encouraged me not to take you line by line, through our submissions, simply to say that the first several pages introduce the international framework and suggest that the international framework says don't criminalize, okay, because of all these risks. And may I say, South Africa is not alone. This kind of dynamic is there in many countries around the world. People don't speak up when they should. It's not that we're particularly bad at it. If we then look at the actual laws that the Department of Justice has put forward as being laws in which there are criminal sanctions, sanctions. Our colleagues, as I say, are from, you know, from various jurisdictions. And what we found, and it is our view, that in the Department of Justice, what they've done is pick out sections which say that if you give false evidence, that that's a criminal offence, which is correct, right? So if I give false evidence in a court, if I'm appearing in front of a judicial commission inquiry, if I'm, you know, there's a range of situations where if I lie in that situation, it is a criminal offence. We would say that that is not what we are talking about. We're talking about the workplace. It's not a court. It's not a commission or inquiry. This is me saying to my boss, what's going on with the cooking oil? And, you know, maybe I ought reasonably to have known that the information was false, but I think it's true. Is that seriously something that we're going to treat as a criminal offence? And I would add, there is sometimes a tendency to say, well, we'll make it a criminal offence. We won't actually prosecute people, really. We just want to send a signal that it's a really bad thing. I'm against taking that line, because I think if you pass a law, you must implement the law. You must have a serious intention of, if people do this thing, you're going to prosecute them. So, you know, I would take a different view on that. We've set out the sections in the opinion on the various laws and why we say that they do not contain criminal sanctions. The one law internationally that does create criminal sanctions is India. And that was a very important fact for the Portfolio Committee. They were like, India, that's big. However, we would point out that law is very controversial in India. It has not come into force. It's got a very specific aim, which is to establish a mechanism to receive complaints. So it's not a court, it's not a commission of inquiry, but you establish a mechanism, and then you've got to provide your adequate safeguards. So you identify an individual public servant. What happens then is if you make the disclosure in bad faith, mala fide, and you know it was incorrect, not you ought reasonably to have known, but you know for sure that it's wrong, then there is a criminalization of the false disclosures. It looks like that may be amended. The point of the Indian legislation is not to protect people in the workplace. It's to go after corrupt officials, which is just one aspect of our law. It's not the whole story. We go through the various other pieces of legislation internationally. We point to the recent passage of legislation in Ireland. There was a recent deliberate decision not to include the criminalization of false disclosures because of the reasons that I've given. The Ghanaian law, which is certainly more recent than ours, provides that the whistleblower is not liable. What it does, however, and we are quite happy with that, is say that if you make a false disclosure, you're not protected in the workplace. Of course you're not protected in the workplace. It's not a proper disclosure. And the workplace sanctions then follow. And of course what we have to remember in South Africa, with the level of unemployment that we have and the difficulty in getting another job, if you've got a reference from your previous employer that's a bad reference, that's a really big deal. That is not a small thing. So we think that there's a specific local context which you know makes it something that we adequately deal with. This international group have commented favorably on the rest of the bill. I think that they also think that the bill goes a long way to fixing, you know, the issues that we've had with the legislation. And I have to say, from our point of view, it's really all that stands between us and this legislation being really world class is that section, is Section 9B. And we would really ask this committee to reevaluate this section and what it does and doesn't do. We believe it will create a chilling effect. We believe that it will stop people from raising concerns in the workplace. And we know that raising concerns in the workplace is essential. If it's a hospital and people not receiving correct treatment, if it's an NGO and people are not receiving the right care, you know, if it's a government department and there is for some reason endemic racism, sexism, sexual harassment, I mean, these are all issues that it is in our interests to get sorted. And I think that that's really the appeal that we would put to you, is to reconsider the introduction of 9B.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Let's go to the corruption watch. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and the committee gathered today. Please forgive me, my voice is a bit hoarse today. Myself and my colleague Leanne will be giving a joint presentation. So
it's
where
not
I
about the Valentine's Day yesterday.
That's a long story, Chairperson. So where I omit some information, my unit head, Leanne, will add on at the end. In keeping with the manner in which our colleagues at ODAC have presented, we'll try to be as brief as possible. Firstly, for those who don't know, we are Corruption Watch. We're an NGO. We are an independent organization with no business or political alignment. Our biggest concern is for open and fearless reporting of corruption in South Africa. We'd firstly also like to extend a big thank you to the department for considering most of our submissions made in our previous hearing. We've noted them in the updated amendment bill, so thank you. We have three focuses that we want to look at today, briefly, because I think all the members gathered here today have these written submissions, so I'll just be brief. We want to look at the extended definition of the occupational detriment. Secondly, Section 9, which excludes civil and criminal liability for protected disclosures. And the last topic will be Section 9B, which is the introduction of offenses for making disclosures in bad faith. With the first two topics, we'll discuss them in tandem because they're kind of linked and our issues are the same. With occupational detriment, the definition has been updated, and it says and includes being subjected to any civil claim for the alleged breach of a duty of confidentiality or a confidentiality agreement arising out of the disclosure of a criminal offense. And when we look at Section 9A, on the other hand, it says a court may find that an employer or worker who makes a protected disclosure of information in accordance with paragraph A of the disclosure, definition of disclosure, or which shows or tends to show that a substantial contravention of or failure to comply with the law has occurred, is occurring, or is likely to occur, shall not be liable to any civil, criminal, or disciplinary proceedings by reason of having made the disclosure of such disclosure is prohibited by any other law, contract, practice, agreement, requiring him or her to maintain confidentiality, otherwise restricting the disclosure of the information with respect to the matter. Our concern is that both of these definitions speak to the same issue, but the protection afforded under occupational detriment and then under Section 9A are very different. Whereas occupational detriment is very narrow, it doesn't extend to all forms of protected disclosures made. Section 9A, on the other hand, protects all forms of protected disclosures. So we're requesting that the department and the committee secretary to revisit those two sections to try and align them, because as it stands now, we will find ourselves confused, and I'm pretty sure for all other onlookers of the legislation are unsure as to how do we apply the different sections at different times. So our proposal then would be, after the department has considered our submissions, that Section 9A, or a definition for that covers both occupational detriment and Section 9A, should read as follows. A court may find that an employer or worker who makes a protected disclosure shall not be liable to any civil, criminal, or disciplinary proceedings by reason of having made the disclosure if such disclosure is prohibited by any law, contract, practice, or agreement requiring him or her to maintain confidentiality or otherwise restricting the disclosure of the information with respect to a matter. So what we're saying is here is that regardless of the type of offense that you're disclosing, whether it has civil or criminal consequences, both should be protected. The third issue is Section 9B, which our colleagues have gone into extensive research about, and it's quite important. It's the issue that relates to the new offense for the disclosure of false information. This section is quite significant, especially in the work that ODAC and Corruption Watch does. We will try to promote as much whistleblowing or informing authorities of all unlawful and corrupt activities that occur. And such a piece of legislation has the effect of stopping whistleblowing completely, because it tells employers if you make a false disclosure, there are serious criminal consequences for that, and I don't think that's a very good deterrent. It's a very bad deterrent. For instance, labor law exists for a reason, and we've expressed extensively about that. If an employee makes intentionally a false disclosure about a fellow employee or an employer or anyone who works within the same department as them or company as them, they're still liable to labor law legislation. They can still be dismissed under that law. They don't have to face criminal consequences for making a false disclosure. And significantly, I mean, sometimes we've all been exposed to this as well. You can be so sure of something that when you make that disclosure, after serious consideration of the investigation that go into it, it turns out to be false. And that report was disclosed in good faith. So we're just asking that the department and the committee revisit Section 9B. The chilling effect that it has is insurmountable. Just in closing, our general commentary in relation to protected disclosures, the amendment bill, I should say. The bill itself is growing, and it's growing in quite well. however, we still feel that at some level it's inaccessible to the man on the street. I, for myself, before I started at Corruption Watch and before preparing for the interview, I was taken aback. I didn't know this legislation existed until I was preparing for the interview. So it needs to be made accessible, and it needs to be taught to people as well, especially departments, government departments. It needs to be made accessible to them. So workshop and training needs to take place. And in closing, I think I'll leave any unmentioned things to my unit head. But thank you to the chairperson, the committee, and the department for this opportunity.
Thank you, Nshlimulo. I think my colleague has covered most of the real concerns that we have about this legislation, and I just want to emphasize the need for clarity around the legislation, particularly around the occupational detriment and then the exclusion of civil and criminal liability. If you look at the definition of an occupational detriment, like Nshlimulo said, you know, it's being subjected to a civil claim for the alleged breach of a duty of confidentiality. And then there's a subsection E that says, but does not include a disclosure in respect of which the employee or worker commits a criminal offense by making that disclosure. But then you go to the actual section 9A, and it says a court may find that an employee or worker who makes a protected disclosure shall not be liable to any civil, criminal, or disciplinary proceedings. And for us, it's really about clarity. We also have a hotline. We have various channels for people to report corruption to us. And in doing so, most people come to us for advice on what should I do going forward? I have this information. Where can I go? How must I do it? And you can imagine the kind of situation we would be placed in interpreting this legislation and saying to them, well, in these circumstances, maybe, but, you know, the legislation is unclear as to what would happen if you breach a duty of confidentiality or if there's a criminal offense that results, and maybe they give us part of the story in explaining their situation to us, and we give them advice, but in fact, there may be unintended consequences that result. And that for us is the real concern. You know, this legislation is aimed at protecting whistleblowers. And in order for them to be protected, they must clearly understand the legislation. And if we as lawyers don't fully understand the legislation or are having difficulty in interpreting it and cross-referencing the section, you can imagine the difficulty that ordinary people would have. And so that's really the point we want to drive home today. You know, I think the related point around the educational aspects of it, we noted at the end of the Act, there's a duty, on the department to make sure, there's a provision for guidelines to be issued and that organs of state must give these guidelines to employees and workers. And there's, I think, a little bit of a gap in relation to the private sector. We'd really want, clarity on how the private sector is implementing this legislation and making available both the guideline and the legislation in the way that, you know, other pieces of legislation are maybe broken down and placed on walls, for example. I'm not sure that there's a similar duty that's being imposed on the private sector, and if they fail in that duty, what then are the consequences? Who's overseeing what the private sector does here? Because, you know, we are often faced with the question around why are you investigating or looking at corruption that occurs in the public sector and not the private sector? And in fact, it's because public sector officials report more often to us than private sector employees. And is it not a consequence of public sector officials feeling or knowing about this legislation more than private sector employees? That private sector employees feel like, well, I have no protection. I've never heard of this particular piece of legislation. I can't report to anybody, or I can't seek even advice from an organization like Corruption Watch in order to report to my employee. And, I really think knowing about the steps you can take ensures that there's responsible reporting, which is what we want at the end of the day. I think those are our submissions. We've referred to OECD reports as well as the UNODC reports in preparing these submissions, which really put together some best practices that, you know, the committee may want to consider as you move forward in deciding on the legislation and its various aspects. Thank you.
Thank you very much from the Corruption Watch. I would like to ask the gentleman there to introduce himself. I don't know.
Thank you, sir. My name is Bafundi. Sinim Njapi. I'm from the office of the Chief Legal Advisor. Thank you.
Honorable members, I don't know whether we ask questions or we give over to the department to end. The department. Over to the Department of Justice. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Let's see. Yes, Mr. Monoma.
Sir?
Yeah, I was just reminding myself in the comment. Thank you very much. Over to you, Zitlo.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to ask Mr. Dupriya to take you through a document that was prepared. What's wrong? And this document really deals with the two issues in broad terms, not word for word addressing each and everything in the document, but it deals with the false disclosures that the two organizations are so opposed to, and it also deals with the issue about occupational detriment. So I'm going to ask Mr. Dupriya to take us through the views of the department. These views, I've got to must say, are the views that were expressed in the portfolio committee. The portfolio committee, I feel it's my duty to say, I felt very strongly about this clause, clause 9B, about false disclosures, and we will try and say in our presentation why this clause is there. What I would like to say, which Mr. Dupriya will touch on, and it's a pity maybe we should have just had a bit more of an opportunity to discuss this with Ms. Tilly from ODAC on the legislation that she's referred to in the WIN document, referring to different laws in different countries where it is suggested that the department might have misread or misinterpreted the way we've set out what these laws seek to achieve. I myself am still a bit confused and really don't understand those issues, but Mr. Dupriya will deal with those, with that contention. We don't want to misrepresent it all, but some of the countries and the legislation we think is whistleblower legislation, and there's maybe we don't understand where they're coming from. So I would just like to highlight that particular point, but can I ask Mr. Dupriya to take us through that?
Thank you, Chair. I think I would like to deal with there were mainly two issues raised, Mr. Chair, by the commentators. The one is the technical issue of occupational detriment versus Clause 9A or the proposed new Section 9A. I would like to deal with that one first, because on the technical level, we do agree with Corruption Watch, and possibly after the meeting, we would like to maybe just on a technical drafting level have a further discussion with them. But just to point out, Mr. Chair, Corruption Watch, their technical concern is that the definition of occupational detriment and the new proposed Section 9A dealing with the exclusion of criminal and civil liability needs to be aligned. The proposed new Section 9A in the introduced version of the bill only refers to the disclosure of criminal offences. But the proposed new Section 9A was amended in the Portfolio Committee to include reference to information which shows or tends to show that a substantial contravention or failure to comply with the law has occurred. Now, we agree with the proposal or recommendation by Corruption Watch to the extent that the definition of occupational detriment should then be aligned to the proposed new Section 9A 1 sub B. However, Corruption Watch then further recommends that criminal and civil liability should not only be excluded in limited circumstances. namely in the case of criminal offences or substantial contravention of the law. They recommend that it should apply in respect of any disclosure as defined. The department's response in that regard, Mr. Chair, is that we do not agree or that we do not support that recommendation, because any breach of confidentiality is a serious matter and should be approached with care in order to avoid any possible negative consequences that are justifiably prevented by confidentiality agreements. The disclosure of a criminal offence or a substantial contravention of the law is of a serious enough nature to justify the alleged breach of confidentiality. Now, Mr. Chair, false disclosures. Let's get right into it. maybe I would just like to mention something in general to the committee. When we look at whistleblower protection legislation in other countries, it's sometimes difficult to do comparisons, because South Africa actually has a very progressive piece of legislation, to the extent that our disclosures relate to a very wide range of workplace improprieties in the first instance. In the second instance, Mr. Chair, the Protected Disclosures Act apply to both public and private sectors. So that is always very important to take into consideration. Many countries limit their legislation to what they call public interest disclosures, where the work or improprieties in the civil service come under scrutiny, and protections are built in to allow people to make those disclosures with regard to civil servants that do not do their work or make themselves guilty to improprieties. Now, we have prepared this document, Mr. Chair. It is there for the committee to read. We are not going to go through it line by line. But what I would like to point out to the Chair is, first of all, it is accepted that some of the examples that we used cannot be coined exclusively whistleblower protection legislation. However, it approves one point, and that is that false disclosures are criminalized by means of legislation, even if those countries have common law remedies in respect of false disclosures. We have, in fact, referred to one example where we can talk about the disclosure or the criminalization of false disclosures when it comes to an exclusive piece of whistleblower protection legislation, and that is in the case of Australia. We understand to mean that the legislation does not reflect the offence concerned in this specific Whistleblower Protection Act, but it references the criminal code of the Australians. So the Section 11 of the Public Interest Disclosures Act, read with Sections 137.1 and 137.2 of the Australian Criminal Code, provides for criminal liability in respect of false or misleading information and false or misleading documents, respectively. When you look at the states, am I correct in referring to them as states, of Australia? We have Section 56 of the Queensland Whistleblower Protection Act, which provides specifically for the criminalization of false or misleading information, and then also Section 10 of South Australia, their Whistleblower Protection Act, provides also for an offense with regard to making false disclosures. Mr. Chair, when we come to the consequences of a false disclosure, and we have dealt with it in our document, and we would like maybe just to mention to you, Mr. Chair, that our Protected Disclosures Act requires persons who make information available or who make disclosures to act in a responsible manner. That is the first and important thing. If what you have said does not qualify as a disclosure, it is true. You will not be entitled to the remedies that is provided for in the Act if you are subjected to an occupational detriment. But what we would like to emphasize, Mr. Chair, is that there are sometimes serious consequences associated with false disclosures. The one example that we've used, and it was merely a matter of possibly convenience and trying to achieve word economy, is the whole issue of reputational damage. Now, it is a serious matter. It can take a very long time to test the veracity of information. In that process, a person or an institution, more importantly an institution, can be compromised as a result of such disclosures. We've also become concerned about fake news and what that type of disclosures might have on an institution or an individual. Fake news can be distributed under the guise of Section 9 of the Act, a general protected disclosure. So, in short, Mr. Chair, the offence, as Ms. Dilley from ODAC indicated, has undergone a bit of tightening up in the Portfolio Committee, to the extent that if you compare it